Hello, welcome to the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. That was Moonlight in Vermont from the 746 Far East Air Force Band. They recorded that at the end of the war before the band were broken up and they all went their separate ways. In this episode, I'm talking to Jason Burt about his grandfather, Richard. Richard was part of the band based in the Philippines. He brought home that recording you just heard, and squirreled it away to be rediscovered when he sadly passed away. Jason, thanks for joining me. Before we get to those recordings, let's have a chat about your grandfather, Richard Burt. How did he get into the military?
He is drafted into the Army in 1943. He's inducted at Fort Douglas over in Salt Lake City and gets sent down to Camp Kearns for basic training. He had a fortunate meeting there. He had a buddy, Max Dalby, who was in the band already down there. Max had gotten his serial number and things of that nature and passed it along to his CO in the band. And really, that's what kind of saved my grandpa from doing a less desirable job in the Army, because he says he was slated to be a latrine technician digging holes for somebody to, you know, so.
Yeah. So presumably he could already play. What was his instrument? The trumpet?
Yeah, he was a trumpet player. So, and that's what he did all of his life as a kid. He wasn't very scholastic or anything like that. And he knew from a young age that he was just going to be a musician. And so he played his trumpet daily. His mom was a piano teacher. So music was his life. And he knew that was going to, he couldn't even read until high school. So music was going to be for him. And the way he describes his basic training was nobody wanted to stand near him on the rifle range because he was that bad of a shot. So that's probably why they were going to stick him as a latrine technician.
He's young, fit and healthy, isn't he? So it's one of those things that the Army wants every young, able man they can. And somehow he gets through their grasp as being an 18-year-old into the band.
It's kind of unheard of. You know, the band is really, I mean, you had to be good to be in the band. He made friends with this guy, Max Dalby, while he was at a university. But he was on the younger end. Like, he didn't graduate high school, but he got a scholarship to go to college still to play his instrument. But he was so young, he was just going to be slated for that. And the only thing that really saved him was this more seasoned musician, Max Dalby, who plucked him out of the latrine of life and stuck him in the Army band over there at Kearns.
So who else is in the it's the Army Air Force, isn't it?
Yeah,
who else is in it? Where are they recruiting from? Are they literally just taking musicians who've volunteered for the Army or being drafted?
Most of the musicians where he was in Utah were just, let's see, so like university type musicians, guys who had bachelor's degrees and things like that, younger guys, older music teachers would have been like the officers in the group. And things like that. So he started off in the band over there at Camp Kearns, this small basic training depot in Utah. And eventually he gets transferred down to Southern California. And that's where he kind of broadened his playing ability, because he was already a really, really good trumpet player. Like everywhere he played as a kid, through high school, through university, he was first trumpet everywhere he went. But he gets sent down to March Field in Southern California over in Riverside. And it's just the hub for musicians. Three-fourths of March Field were guys who were in nationally known swing bands, or they were Hollywood recording musicians. And that's kind of the guys you picture and the guys you really hear about during World War II being in these bands, like the Glenn Miller types. And so he was around all these really talented guys, talented himself, but he was 19. So he gets down to Riverside with all these guys, and he's there for about 11 months just soaking up how to play his horn on that level.
That's when he plays taps at Ed Dyess's funeral. Is that when he's there? You better remind the people who I've actually looked at Ed Dyess, episode 65. But you know, can you remind us who Ed Dyess was and why this is such a big thing to play taps at his funeral?
Ed Dyess is just, if you know Philippine campaign history or Pacific history, Ed Dyess is just next level heroic, amazing story. He was part of the only mass breakout of a Japanese POW camp out in the Philippines. But he survives all this stuff out in the Philippines. And he comes home and he's preparing to go. I believe he's going to go to Europe. They don't want to send him back out to the Pacific. And he's just getting his feet wet back in the plane again. and he's flying over Burbank, California, and his engine gives out, and he's going to land his plane. Just some bad luck. A car pulls out in front of him when he's about to land, and he pulls up, and rather than kill or injure any civilians, he crashes his plane at a vacant lot. And so a very sad ending to somebody who he really deserved a Medal of Honor for a lot of the stuff he did. My grandpa ends up playing taps for him. Him and the three other trumpet players in his unit over there, they used to rotate. It didn't matter who it was or whatever. It was whoever's turn it was, but they were going to go play taps. And so when Ed Dias's funeral came about for military honors and stuff like that down in Southern California, my grandpa was tapped to play taps for him. And he always considered that a great honor his whole life. It's even when I interviewed him in 2010, he's all, you know, that really stuck with me because it was one of my first times playing taps. And Ed Dias was just a hero to everyone. Everyone knew who Ed Dias was back then.
He's then assigned to the Far East Air Force Band, the 746. So
yeah, 746.
How does he get assigned to that?
He doesn't actually. So he's down there. I'd say he's in Southern California, and he's soaking up all this trumpet skill from all these nationally known swing band players. And a call comes in down to March Field, and it's for a trumpet player with a sergeant's rating. They're forming a band to go overseas. And so my grandpa's just this 20-year-old kid. All the other guys, you know, bigger name guys are who have the sergeant's rating, they're all married and have kids and things like that. And so that didn't sit well with my grandpa. So he walks into his chief warrant officer's office, and he's a private at the time, and says, you know, I'd like to take the place of that married man. His CO just kind of choked up a little bit at the desk at the idea of this kid offering to go in place of somebody who's married. And that's really how his adventure out to the Pacific started. He volunteered to take somebody's place.
It's the Philippines that he's sent to, isn't it? Presumably they're there to entertain the troops predominantly.
Yeah, so they're put aboard a ship up by in Pittsburgh, California, near Camp Stoneman. And they ship out to an unknown destination to them, but it ends up being the Philippines. And so their first stop is Leyte in the Philippine campaign.
Do they? I assume they don't directly see combat. They operate as a band, as entertainment.
That's probably what was told to them. Seeing that they're in the Pacific, you had no idea what was going to happen anywhere. There's the front lines anywhere. There's film of that my grandpa brought home of the band, and you can see them kind of at their camp. And my grandpa's got his carbine and his trumpet, and he's kind of messing around in the film. So he has a narration that's on the album that I created of the recordings from the Philippines. And so he's telling this 30-minute narration. And one of the stories he tells is of their first performances over there in the Philippines. And they get off the ship and they play this show with a USO group called Hell's the Poppin'. He describes it as them being up at the front lines. There's soldiers climbing up blown out palm trees to attach spotlights. They put on a makeshift stage. All the soldiers there are there with their rifles sticking out and their ponchos on because it's rainy. And the show starts and fighting breaks out directly behind them, just across a little ravine that's behind them. And so they're basically doing a show on the front line. And you know, in the Pacific, it's you could have your MOS of being in the band or being a cook, but you never know what was going to happen. You had to have your rifle nearby.
Sounds like a scene from Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
So how often are they playing? I mean, are they just tour around night after night?
He describes them playing, so practice during the day regularly. He doesn't say exactly how often they play shows. I imagine they played shows with USO groups pretty sparingly, like here and there. And things like that. But they played for guys constantly on the front lines, not daily or anything like that. But, you know, if the battle's not going on, there's nothing to do there. And so morale needed to be boosted. And so they would play these shows and they would play dances. And they played one military formation the entirety of their time in the Pacific. And it was for another group of famous Philippine veterans. And it was the Nurses of Bataan. The Angels of Bataan, when they got their medals for their POW experience. So my grandpa was fortunate enough to cross paths with a lot of characters from the Philippine campaign that were you know, to us, they're just iconic historians, just the Nurses of Bataan and Dias.
It's not, but it makes it sound like a small world.
Yeah, no, it really does. And for a 19-year-old kid who really had no, nobody knew who he was, but yet he's playing taps for Ed Dias, and he gets to cross paths with the Nurses of Bataan too. And they played shows for dignitaries and generals and things like that, because when they were stationed in Manila, they were at the headquarters for Far East Air Force. So they played for a lot of top brass out there too.
When the war comes to an end, what happens to their band? Do they just sort of break up the formation? Is that the plan?
Yeah. So the plan comes down, the war ends, VJ Day happens, and everybody's happy. And so the band is going to go home. And before they go home, they decide to make a recording. And, for a frontline band unit, it just doesn't happen because you don't have access to recording or anything like that. And so these guys were fortunate enough that there was a group coming by, a special unit of two guys who happened to have a wire recorder with them. And with their limited equipment and things like that, they set up a janky little thing to record themselves doing their usual set. And that's how they wanted to end the war. It was just playing a set and recording it and having that moment. And so my grandpa's got it written in his diary thing over here where, they only had a mic that was suitable for just the lead singer. So it wasn't made to pick up all the sounds. And that was hanging to a pole in the middle of the performance tent. And the wire recorder ran from that tent across the compound to another tent where those guys were operating the wire recorder. And so you read about, and my grandpa talks about in his narration track on the album, talks about the creation of the album itself too. And it's just really amazing how it came out to sound and everything. I mean, it sounds really good for being, it was made out in the middle of the war, basically. This wasn't made in a studio. It's just really amazing how it came together and how it even survived 75 years.
When you think of studios now, there's this massive mixing desk, there's people pushing faders up and down, and it's going on to, well, it was not anymore, but classically it would go on to magnetic tape. What's a wire recorder? What format is that recording onto? That discs?
That is so antiquated that I don't know the answer to that. I haven't even looked at it. My grandpa, because he came home with the original wire recordings, and that's what he tells me about. And so I've never actually looked at what it is, because he came home with the original wire recordings and had them pressed to 78s on vinyl in 1948. And that's where I took the recordings from, are these 78s. People have asked me what happened to the original wire. And I want to say he says it got ruined in his narration, and he feels badly about it. But the records survived.
It was a hole in my knowledge. Because magnetic tape gets to us via Hitler, via Mr. Ampex. It invents magnetic tape. And I thought, well, it can't be recording on magnetic tape. I wonder if they use sort of wax discs or something. I know the BBC used to record in the field on sort of record discs.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, there's a great story of a raid on Berlin, and they take up Winfield Hayes, the journalist, and he's in the plane, and he's narrating what's going on, and he has his sound recordist, and these discs have a wax sheen on them, but at 20,000 feet or whatever they're flying, the wax has to be kept warm enough for the needle to break. So the sound recordist has got all these discs shoved in his flight jacket to prevent them getting too cold, so he can put the next one on,
right?
So it carries on working. Yeah, because it's amazing. This is why the magnetic tape for recording, which Mr. Ampex brings home from Germany, is such a massive leap forward when we're still looking at discs.
Yeah, wax, no, definitely
wax bits on. So, what did your grandfather plan on doing with the recordings? Is he just keeping them as keepsakes?
Yeah, so they finished recording, and they did their set, and he asked his CO, he just asked if he can have him. I mean, he's a young kid. He probably just wanted to remember his buddies by it, and his CO said, yeah, go ahead and take him home. And so he brought him home, and he had no plans. I mean, he brought him home for himself to share with the people he loved. It was for his posterity. In the 80s is the last time any of us ever saw. About 84, he recorded his World War II narration, took two of the songs off record and stuck them on a tape. And those were the only two songs I ever heard growing up. There's 10 songs total, but the ones where he's featured the most as a soloist, he pulled off, and it's Moonlight in Vermont and Harry James' Trumpet Rhapsody. So those are the ones I heard growing up my whole life. He does that in 84, tucks them away somewhere, and as he gets older, he just doesn't really, I don't know if it ever crossed his mind, or I imagine it just faded from his mind where exactly it was. He didn't pass away until 2016. And then my grandma passed away in 2019. And that's when we kind of came across the other records up in the attic.
I mean, I guess you weren't looking for them. You just sort of going through the things and then there's these discs.
Like we knew they existed, but I mean, we hadn't seen them since the 80s. We didn't know if they broke and he threw them out. He didn't really say much about them. And so we came across them and it was a surprise to see them, but we knew they existed. So it was nice to find them, and even nicer the first time I put them on and to see if they work. Cause I mean, they're 75-year-old records. You don't really expect them to work. And so I played them, and there's definitely some vinyl sounds and stuff like that. They worked. And so we had this amazing treasure from the Pacific.
Now, before we get to what you've done with them, should we fill in the gap what did your grandfather do after the military?
Like I said earlier, he knew he was going to be a musician his whole life. He spent most of the war preparing for life after the war. And so when his buddies in the band would have some downtime, they'd finish their practicing for the day. They'd go play chess or pinochle or whatever they were going to play out there, read books. My grandpa would sneak off into the jungle outside of camp so he wouldn't bother anyone. And he would practice his trumpet 2 to 3 hours extra every day, just practicing out in the jungle, because he knew that was going to be it for him after the war was musicianship. And, you know, I'm not quite sure he gets to the level he was at without the war, because he got to study under the tutelage of those guys down in Southern California. He got to play shows. I mean, what could be more make you more of a seasoned musician to playing shows for guys who have seen action, who could just care less if you suck? They'd let you know. It was a great tool for him to practice his craft and get better. And without that, I don't think he moves on to the musician he became. He went to Juilliard after the war, graduated from their program there, went to Iowa to a place called Drake University, and he was in the Drake University Orchestra. He was in the Des Moines Symphony Orchestra. When he's in the orchestra, he decides, you know, this is kind of taking up being a musician's like an all-day gig. And so, and he wants to have a family, and he essentially chose his family. He gave up being in the symphony orchestra and got into teaching, and he ended up teaching school children mostly the rest of his life in public schools, teaching them music. So
that's the dream teacher. I had a maths teacher who'd served in the war, so it was always someone you could divert to. So, sir, tell me about your time in the RAF during the war.
You know, it's when I was in high school, and I knew my grandpa was in the war, but I didn't know what extent. And when I was in high school, that's when World War II really became my thing, and history became my thing. And I was a European theater guy. And so when I found out my grandpa was in the Pacific, that was a disappointment. And then I found out that he didn't win a Medal of Honor, and that was a disappointment. So I really didn't appreciate what my grandpa did in the war until much later in life. His wife, my grandma, had a brother who was a medic over in the 94th Infantry Division over in Europe, who saw action and things like that. And some of the stuff in his life afterward, you know, he'd hear a car backfire and he'd have to like hit the ground in public places and things like that. And although my grandpa played shows with the front right there, he didn't have any experiences like that really just altered his life. And I mean, he came away from the war with that innocence still intact with him. And he added this kindness to him his whole life. And growing up as a kid, I really didn't appreciate that. But later on in life, when I compared him to my great uncle, it was just, I'm so grateful that he didn't have to go through any of that really, really serious stuff, like toting his rifle everywhere and being in a foxhole and things like that. So I'm grateful he had that musician experience during the war.
So you've taken the original 78s and you've had them remastered. What's the process you've had to go through with the remastering? I mean, it's quite a big, it's one of those remastering. Have you managed to make them sound, you know, like they were recorded yesterday kind of thing? Or are they still crackle and pop and you've taken a lot of it away? And how bad were they?
The first run through, I had worked with a Grammy winning sound engineer. The initial run through with them, they got them transferred digitally and they cleaned them up the best they could. And the music sounded amazing, really enhanced audio and things like that. But it enhanced the crackles and the pops the first run through. And so they had said, you know, this is probably as good as it's going to get. And really the vinyl sounds and the popping were almost as loud as the music. And I thought, oh man, that's too bad. And I was doing a jazz podcast there's a jazz musician who's the host and he's got his own sound engineer and he wanted to premiere one of the songs. And so I sent him one of the songs and he had his sound engineer work on it. And the story kind of takes an interesting turn there too. He's working on this and somehow he got it to where the vinyl, you can still hear the vinyl, but it's not, it's so much lower than it was. And the sound is of the musician. So it has that nostalgic sound to it as if you're listening to an old time record, but it's not overpowering the music. So it's in a good spot right now where I feel like it's, you can tell what it is. It was never going to sound like it was in a studio. And sometimes I get questions from people, like some of my students who have heard it will say something like, you know, I don't, why does it sound like that? That doesn't sound that. And I like to tell them, you know, this album has a story to it. And any World War II artifact, are you going to want the rifle or the, or anything like that, that came off the factory line that doesn't have a story to it? Or you want the thing that has a story to it? So that's kind of how I explain it to my students.
Tell them that, you know, how many microphones do you think are in a modern drummer and a band now? They had one to share.
Yeah. So it's been an interesting ride. And the guy who remade the album, the second sound engineer who reworked everything most recently, he worked tirelessly on this thing. And the interesting side of his story is he had such a connection to this because he's in the music industry, but he works in New York, but he's from Japan. And his grandpa was in the same part of the world, but on the opposite side of the United States in the war. His dad fought, or was a medic with the Japanese. So interesting twists and turns on the project. It's been definitely a fun and interesting ride to meet all these different people and all that kind of stuff.
You've made it available for people to purchase, and part of the proceeds go to the United Service Organization?
The whole album project kind of started with the World War II Museum. When I found out the records worked, I said, hey, would you guys be interested in like putting this on the shelf? And the guy emailed me back and he said, yeah, something to the effect of, but it can't look amateurish, even though that's what these guys are. They're amateur musicians. He said that, and it really kind of tweaked the project to a different direction. And I started thinking to myself, you know, he's right. If I get an album and I just put this on the shelf and nobody knows the story or anything like that, no one's going to buy this because these guys, they're not Glenn Miller. They're not Artie Shaw. No one's going to know anything about it if they just see this on the shelf. So then it became, how can I get their story out there? I came up with the idea of, you know, let's raise some money for the group that they played shows with out in the Philippines, the USO. And at the same time, in the world of streaming music, let's try and give these guys an actual artist experience where we're trying to make them a platinum selling artist. So the whole idea is we're going to try and sell a million albums with the USO and try and get some accolades and put the spotlight on these guys' role during the war, which was boosting morale and things like that, and raise some money for the USO in the process.
So have you made the whole original recordings available, all of them?
Yeah, so it came out on Veterans Day, and the album has 10 songs plus the 30-minute narration by my grandpa that tells of his whole time in the war as a musician all down to Southern California. It's got a little intro that he made in the 80s where he introduces the first song and he says where they're made and everything. He also came home with film of the actual band. It's about 9 minutes of film of the band practicing out in the Philippines. And not if you buy it on iTunes or Amazon, but if you buy off the band website, it's a multimedia thing where you get the album, the 12 tracks from the album, plus the digital film of the band out in the Philippines. So it's really, it's it's kind of a neat experience for them to have, because since it's multimedia too, it's like watching World War II in color of this band out in the Philippines. So it's pretty neat.
Well, you better tell us the website.
The website is www.746feaf.com. So if you go to that website that I just gave, it's got a button links. If you need to go buy it on iTunes, there's a button you click for that. If you need to go buy it on Amazon, there's a button that'll take you directly to it from the band website.
Is it on Spotify?
Yeah, it is actually.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's on Spotify.
Is the whole thing on Spotify?
You mean the film?
The narration?
Yeah, the narration.
Oh, no, I mean...
Yeah, no.
Fantastic.
The whole actual album's on all the streaming platforms too. So you can stream it on Pandora or Spotify or anything like that. But yeah, but if you want the actual film, I was only able to attach the film to the band website. Yeah.
Well, of course. I have to say the film's a really nice touch.
Yeah, no, a lot of people seem to like that.
Well, you don't often get people's sort of home films of the war. You kind of, it's seen through newsreels. So something
right.
personal like that's really nice of how the guys saw themselves rather than how a news crew saw.
Yeah, no, and they had some. It's most of the film is them practicing their instruments, them goofing around in the war. It's good to see it's funny to see their jocularity out in their camp in the tents and stuff like
that. Color or black and white?
Both.
Oh, good grief.
Both.
Fantastic.
And they actually, there's the film also has them. So my grandpa and another guy in the group had pet monkeys out there in the Philippines. So there's some film of them playing with their monkeys and things like that. It's pretty entertaining stuff.
Fantastic. Because it's 16mm is the color film, which gets used in the Pacific because the Navy liked color. So the Navy liked using color film because they thought it was more impactful. Whereas the Army, especially when it's shown on the big screen. So the Army... who obviously more in Northwest Europe, thought quality was better rather than colour. So they shoot 35mm in Europe. That's why there's almost no colour film of the Northwest Europe campaign compared to, there's lots of colour film for the Pacific. So I wonder if your grandfather's lifted some of that military 16mm stock Kodak film, and that's where they've run it through.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the funny thing about the war in the Pacific is you can see it in color, and so it's home video of that is even more cool. Whereas Northwest Europe, there's very very little, and some of the stuff they did find they do have is actually 16mm home. Film, not official military film, because one of the cameramen had his own stock of color and he filmed it as a kind of one of the newsreel camera guys who shoots black and white officially and for his home film is 16mm color.
For his home, he's got the color.
Yeah, so that's that. But there's very little for Northwest Europe. But yeah, that's fantastic, absolutely wonderful. Well, give us the website again for if people have missed it.
The website is www.746feaf.com.
Thanks, Jason. I'll put a link to that on the website and in the show notes. Loyal listener, I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode and the last of the year. I'd just like to take a moment to say thank you all for listening and to raise a glass of your favourite tipple to say cheers to all those patrons of the podcast who support the show. Thank you. So, see you in 2021. I wish you all a very happy Christmas. I'll leave you with a little bit more from the 746 Far East Air Force Band. Here you are with Moonlight in Vermont.